Before I moved to California, I was living in Massachusetts, and I worked full-time as a psychotherapist. And the tradition that I was a therapist in is called psychosynthesis, which is considered to be a spiritual psychology. And within that, there were a number of models and methods and language that we used to help us understand and work as therapists. One of the ways we would think about our clients and work with our clients was asking the questions, what's blocking them and what's emerging within them? What's blocking my client and what's emerging? And the blocking was, of course, looking at the conditioning, our habits, our confusion, our delusion, the things that get in way of what's naturally emerging. And in, of course, the Buddhist tradition, we might say what's naturally emerging is our Buddha nature. So this can be an interesting or useful, I find it useful, to use this model in terms of our spiritual or meditation practice as well. I used to have the image when I was using, I would be assessing a client perhaps, you know, just meeting them and assessing what did it seem like was for the major blocks, what did it seem like was trying to emerge, trying to express itself, trying to show itself. And the image that would come to me often was of a concrete or cement or asphalt sidewalk or street. And we've all seen this at different times. You have this like cement sidewalk, and there somewhere is this little sprout that has pushed through, that has miraculously pushed through, cracked open, and is emerging out through the cement or concrete. So that's the kind of the image or the feeling I have about this work, this model. So when I would work with a client, I could work with either the blocks or what's emerging, and we work with both. And when I was looking at the blocks, it would be how to recognize them. What are they? What are they for this particular person? And then it would be the work perhaps of softening those blocks, of lightening them up, of helping them break up, you might say, of redirecting them, of helping them kind of dissolve. And using the model of the cement and the plant, sometimes people want to, come in with a jackhammer and get at the blocks that way. And I see that both as a therapist, and I see that on a spiritual path. But if you use the jackhammer on the sidewalk, what would happen to that sprout? So when we're working with the blocks, it's not a path of force, of eradication, but it's something much more subtle than that. And for the emergence, when we're looking at, well, what's emerging for that person, it would be recognizing, trying to recognize what that is, trying to feed it, to kind of water it, to help it grow, to cultivate it, to encourage it to come out, to give it space, to give it acknowledgement. So tonight I'm going to talk mostly about working with those blocks. But I will address a little bit about the emerging. So in the Buddhist path, there's a number of lists, traditional lists of different kinds of blocks. There's the hindrances, and which I'll talk about tonight, and there's also the term the kleshas, sometimes translated as the difficult or disturbing emotions or mind states. And the basic three kleshas are greed, hatred, and delusion, the basic three poisons. So what I say tonight in terms of working with these blocks really can be applied to any of them, can be applied to the hindrances, to the kleshas, to whatever we identify, have an experience of as being a very difficult or disturbing emotional mind state. So the hindrances, which many of you are familiar with, and I'll go through them, I see them as kind of patterns of reaction that we all have. We all have these five hindrances in some form, in some time. They're traditionally talked about in relationship to meditation, and I see them in meditation as patterns that block our presence. They're patterns that take us out of the present moment, that engage us or numb us or dull us in some way. So basically they are, review for you. The first one is sometimes called desiring, grasping, or wanting mind. The next one is usually called aversion, but I sometimes like to call it not wanting mind. And the next one can be dullness, sleepiness, traditionally called sloth and torpor. I sometimes prefer the word stupor, which is what I feel sometimes. And then the next one is restlessness or agitation, and the final one is doubt. A couple clarifications I want to make is that, you know, just because one of these comes up doesn't mean that it's a hindrance in the sense that it's really getting in your way. It may be just a kind of natural response, a temporary, very natural response to the situation. So every wanting mind is not necessarily a problem. Just I'll give you some rather simplistic examples. Because sometimes people get very literal and very sort of attached to the word, so then they feel like anytime they want something that it's a problem or a mistake or bad or whatever. So let's just, I'm using some, as I said, simple. Suppose the temperature suddenly dropped 30 degrees and you wanted a blanket. That would be a natural response and not a problem. Suppose the food you were served was actually moldy and rotten. That would create some not wanting. That would be appropriate. In terms of sleepiness, perhaps you haven't slept for a couple nights very well and you're sleepy. That's, again, that's just a natural response. Perhaps you're walking and suddenly you hear the growl of a bear. You might feel agitated. And that's a natural fight or flight response. Again, that's okay. And doubt, again, you might be in a situation where someone says something that you feel you have a strong suspicion is untrue, so you have some doubt. Okay. These are just examples where this were common sense, these are, you know, these aren't necessarily hindrances. So what we're looking for are chronic patterns of our reactions in our mind. And when these chronic patterns start, as I said earlier, start to block our ability to just be present, to just be with what we're experiencing, what's happening. And the first, they're like two pairs and then an individual. So the first pair is the wanting mind and the not wanting mind. They're really two sides of the same process. And I would say that these two appear mostly in the mind, although the body can certainly have a response to it. You might feel this in the body. And the wanting and not wanting mind are usually engaged in some story about what's happening, and some different ideas and so forth. And the wanting mind is generally wishing for what you don't have right now. It's a kind of wishing for what you don't have right now. So, you know, again, if I use a sort of gross example, if you were in prison, I mean a real prison, you would want to be out of prison, probably. And again, that's a natural response. But if all you did, and we all are in kind of prisons in a certain way, but if all you did was obsess about getting out and didn't actually deal with the situation, that's when it becomes a hindrance and it blocks actually responding to what's going on. So I want to just put this out for you to reflect. What has your wanting mind come up with in the last couple of days? What's the top 10? Can you come up with a couple, you know, maybe it has to do with food, or you really want some food you don't have, or some activity that's not available here, or a bed that you don't have, a place you want to be. And how caught by it are you? How caught are you in this wanting mind? Do you believe it? Are you caught in the story of it? Are you taking it very seriously? Or are you able to say, ah, there's wanting mind. There's that pattern of thinking. There's that familiar hindrance. Okay, the next one, the not wanting mind, the aversion, is wishing that we didn't have what we do have. It's wishing that we didn't have what we do have. So, have you noticed any patterns of aversion to things here? Again, with any aversion to food or the schedule, or possibly to your own feelings, your own thoughts, your own sensations, wishing you didn't have what you happen to have. So both these wanting and not wanting minds are the cause, can be cause of great struggle, great dissatisfaction, resistance, and engage in a process that is unwilling to be fully present. The wanting and not wanting mind are often the if only mind. The if only I had such and such. If only I didn't have this pain in my back. I actually, someone now who's a well-known Vipassana teacher, I will not give his name, but I remember early on, before he was a teacher, and I knew him then, and I remember sitting in his kitchen and him saying, you know, if I didn't have all this pain, I'd probably be enlightened by now. And I thought, I don't think so. I'm thinking, if we have to get rid of pain to be enlightened, we're all doomed. And actually, many, many years later, recently, I heard him bring that up in a talk, and talk about how he realized that that wasn't true. So that was good.
Got me some lightning.
So please, pay attention to this if-only mind, if only I were different, if only I had a different personality. That's occurred to me sometimes. If only I had a different childhood. If only, I had a different financial situation. If only I had done something differently for my career. If only I had started meditating earlier in my life. Whatever it might be. It's also related to this wanting and not wanting mind. It's related to, they talk about a little bit more in Tibetan Buddhism of hope and fear, being caught by hope and fear. And hope and fear are just versions of this. Hope and fear, we usually think of hope as a positive thing, and it can be, certain aspects of hope can be. But the hope is really the looking into the future, that when I get there, have that, when that happens, then things will be okay. And fear is looking into the future, and when that happens, when whatever, then I'm not okay. But so they're both anticipations of a future and not being present, not being with what is, which is the only place practice exists, the only place awakening exists, the only place freedom exists. So the next two hindrances, the dullness and restlessness, they're kind of a pair, and I would say they appear in a way more in the body and in our energy. They're also in our mind, certainly, and different beliefs or stories or attitudes in our mind can certainly produce restlessness and dullness. But the actual experience of it is very energetic and body-based. And again, when these are very present and very intense, we can get so kind of knocked off center by them that we lose our capacity, we lose remembering to just be here, remember being able to have enough clarity and energy to just be here. So this dullness and sleepiness is really a kind of too little energy. Our energy is down. And again, it's traditionally called sloth and torpor, which just the words sound right, sloth and torpor. And as I was writing this, I thought, I'm not sure I actually know what sloth and torpor mean. After 30 years of this, and I actually looked it up, and in case you need a refresher, torpor means the lack of mental or physical energy. That fits with. So if you're experiencing a lack of mental or physical energy, and sloth is, I like this one, dislike of any kind of work or physical exertion. So it's really, sloth would be when we just sort of give up and we just don't want to put anything out and we sort of give up on our practice. And torpor is more when we just feel, ugh, that dullness or downness. So it's, again, these are common experiences. This is part of the human experience to go through this to some degree. So again, reflecting on your own experience of this, the ups and downs in a retreat, particularly maybe the downs on the first day or two, what kind of dullness, sleepiness, sloth and torpor you've been experiencing. I do like to add here, and I think this is very important. It's an important to me because it's something I really observe as a teacher and also as a MBSR, mindfulness-based stress reduction teacher, is that part of the dullness and sleepiness that people experience, not only the beginning of a retreat, but at other times, is from a culture-wide chronic lack of appropriate sleep and rest. So I think that is, aside from it just sort of being a pattern of mind, which it can be, but to really consider for yourself your own rest and sleep patterns and how to support that and to help yourself use this time as a kind of stopping and relaxing and resting. So the restlessness and agitation, you might say, is too much energy, too much unfocused energy. It's too much unmanaged energy. It's when our energy is kind of bouncing around and we're kind of can't seem to sit still, can't seem to focus on anything, don't seem to want to do anything. Whatever we're doing, we don't seem to feel comfortable doing it. And my first teacher was a Zen teacher, and a Zen master, and he was Korean, and his English wasn't so good, but he would call this energy up. He would say, this is energy up. And you can sort of see that the energy is ungrounded, it's kind of, not connected. So it can be very useful. There's many reasons for restlessness and agitation. But there's a kind of harmonizing and bringing the energy down and balancing. And sometimes that kind of releasing, walking, things that can release it. But ironically, actually sitting very still with agitation can be very useful to sort of surrender into it. And I'll say more about that in a little bit. The other thing I want to say right now, for both these two, this sleepiness and restlessness, which are an imbalance of energy, one of the things that can be really useful is Qigong. So if you're experiencing that, I'm a long-term practitioner myself of Qigong, maybe 20 years, and it's a very useful practice for bringing these energies, balancing them out, either giving you a little energy or balancing out the high energy. So if you're experiencing that, we have this wonderful opportunity to practice with Marcy, who's very skilled. So the last one is doubt. And doubt's an interesting hindrance. Doubt is something, again, that appears, I would say, mostly in the mind. It can certainly have repercussions in the body, anxiety, or different things. And doubt is usually engaged in some sort of story you have about yourself, about what you're doing, about the world, about spiritual path. And I first want to say that there is a kind of doubt that is important to have. And you might say it's the doubt of critical thinking, it's the doubt of discerning wisdom. And again, in the Zen tradition, which I started out with, my teacher would talk a lot about having great doubt. And that it's important on the path to have great doubt. And what that meant was having a mind that was open and didn't make assumptions, that didn't jump to conclusions, that didn't have preconceived notions about everything, that was curious and present. So that's great doubt, that likes to investigate, that wants to know, that wants to understand. But what is the kind of doubt that's a hindrance? Well, one of the main doubts that's a hindrance over and over again and over again is self-doubt. And that's the one I run into a lot with people. Self-doubt. I'm not good enough. I'm not practicing well enough. I'm not doing it right enough. It'll work for other people, but it won't work for me. I'm too damaged. I'm too wounded. I'm not smart enough. I'm not whatever enough. So this pattern of self-doubt is a really important one to begin to identify, to see it as a pattern, and begin to work with in a compassionate way. And I'll say a little bit more about that in a bit. The other kinds of doubt are doubt about the path itself, doubt about the truth of the Dharma, doubt about the practices, a kind of confusion about should I do this, should I do that, is this the right thing, is that the right thing? And in this, I mean, again, there can be a useful exploration and discernment, because, especially because we're in a culture and society today where you have so many choices and so many possibilities, even within the Theravada tradition. There's so many different ways to go, so many different approaches and teachers and so forth. So there is a level at which you do need to examine what's being offered and make choices. But there is a pattern for people often of a chronic doubt, that it never seems, they're never quite willing to give it a try, they're not quite willing to explore it. The Buddha said to check it out for yourself. And to check it out for yourself, you really have to do it. You have to engage yourself, you have to practice it. And you have to practice it for a while and explore it and find for yourself. So some of you may realize that you have a chronic pattern of doubt, self-doubt, but may also have a pattern of doubting whatever you're doing, whatever path you're on, whatever approach you have. And sometimes people kind of just sort of doubt there is a path. And this is a really important and juicy place to explore as well, because that's where trust and faith needs to come in, where we explore what our doubt is about, and then through our practice eventually coming to a place of great trust in what we're doing. And sometimes that can only happen, again, through practice, through experimentation, through actually seeing it work. OK, Okay, in working with these hindrances, you know, there are a variety of little what are called antidotes or little tricks you can use with them. And mentioned a few, you know, even like doing qigong as a help. And I've mentioned with sleepiness that standing up or having your eyes open, there's different things like that. But that's actually, those approaches aren't the ones that, the approach that I think is most significant and most important and most life-changing. Those are helpful and can be useful in different times. But the most important approach to this is to realize that our difficulties are our practice. Our difficulties are our practice. They aren't something to get rid of so you can practice. Like the story I gave earlier where the person thought that the pain was something to get rid of so that they could be a real yogi, they could be a real meditator. The pain was the practice. The learning to embrace it, the learning to accept it, the learning to work with it skillfully, the learning to allow it to teach one wisdom and compassion, the allowing it to change you. So please look at, in your own mind and heart, when you get caught by, again, this idea that if I get rid of this, that this or that problem, then I can really practice, then thing it'll be smooth sailing. Or if I could just work hard enough to get rid of this personality flaw, then I'd really be a good meditator. It is the hindrances, the difficulties, the kaleshas that actually show us when they come up, when they happen, where we are stuck. They show us what our conditioning really is. And they, whenever they arise, they are an opportunity. They are an invitation to apply wisdom and compassion. Without them, we may not have so many invitations. We're asked to look, we're asked to explore, we're asked to understand. We're asked to go deeper whenever they come up. And this is really how wisdom is created. And our practice, in particular even retreat, is a kind of crucible for that hard stuff, for that difficult stuff. And I looked up crucible. That's one thing that's nice about giving talks. You start to want to make sure you understand what you're talking about. And the definition is a place or set of circumstances where people or things are subjected to forces that test them and make them change. So these difficulties, these hindrances and so forth, they're showing us what we need to see. And they're testing us, allowing us to practice our wisdom and our understanding and a deep acceptance and compassion for ourselves and what's happening. So how do we work with these? What does it mean to, once we see them, once they're arising, what then? Well, the most profound way, I might say, I don't know if profound is quite the right word, but it'll do, is to have this willingness, this courage, this willingness to fully allow, to fully welcome, to fully experience exactly what we're experiencing. Exactly what is arising. And to develop the openness and space so that can happen. So this is a new way of, for many of us have been practicing this for a while, but it's certainly a different way than we learned growing up and in the culture in general. We learned often to judge, to reject, and to try to fix. Some difficulty comes up and we judge it, we judge ourselves. Shouldn't be happening. It's because we're flawed. We reject it, we deny it, we push it away, we try to fix it. But in this approach, we're having the trust and the faith that if we open to it and we allow it to be as it is, from that, it will actually teach us. We will actually expand and open. We will develop more understanding and compassion. You know, why don't we do that? Why do we instead sort of reject and try to fix? It's often because we're afraid of our own experience. We're afraid of the difficult feelings that come up. We're afraid of our own mind and its own unruly habits and patterns. So I often like to say, when I ask the question, what are we really afraid of? And the only thing we're actually ever afraid of is our own experience. There's actually nothing outside of our own experience. So when we think we're afraid of something, we're just afraid of some experience we think we might have. And we're afraid because of the stories we've created around that. And this practice is the practice of, as Rumi said, the practice to welcome and entertain them all. And as we do that little by little, we have more space and more space so that whatever comes up, we can say, this too, this too. I can hold this too. And as we expand, and our fear diminishes about our physical difficulty, our emotional difficulty, as we become more confident, and confidence is a huge part of practice, so we become more confident in our ability to be present with whatever happens, then the fear diminishes and greater peace and greater freedom arrive. And this welcoming and entertaining them all is based in a very big heart. It's based in a very generous, welcoming, interested, non-judgmental, soft but powerful heart. So I'm going to give you a little help maybe in how you do this. I'm breaking it down a little bit. Essentially, this is what mindfulness is. Mindfulness is the kind and open, welcoming approach to being present with whatever is arising. And some of you know this, but there is an acronym called RAIN, R-A-I-N, that can help you see the different components of this wonderful mindfulness that you can use with the hindrances, you can use with any difficult states. So the RAIN stands for recognize, and I have a little addition to each of these. Recognize, and I add on with compassion. Accept with compassion. Investigate with compassion. And not identify with compassion. So what is really in a moment of full full awareness and full mindfulness, these all kind of happen simultaneously. But I think it can be useful for people to hear these teased apart a little bit, so that you might be able to work with it in your own practice as difficult things come up. So first of all, there's the recognize. And the recognition in some ways is certainly just is sort of the acknowledgement, the kind of admitting that what is happening is what is happening and knowing what is happening. So if it's sleepiness, if it's wanting mind has arisen, that you recognize it. The recognizing the recognition is also moving from the story and content to the pattern, to the process. So wanting mind will have its whole story. I want this and I want that and why isn't it this way and I want da, 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 right? That's the way it goes. And what recognition is, wanting mind is here. I see the pattern of that pattern happening. Or you're feeling really resistant and negative and you say, aversion is here. You don't have to worry about what it's about or the story. Aversion is here. I recognize that. I know that. Not only I recognize it, I know it. I welcome it. I welcome it because it's a visitor. Welcome and entertain them all. And then the next one is acceptance. And acceptance means recognizing it with a lack of judgment, without pushing it away, and without ignoring it. It's that full recognition that it is here and I don't have to fight it. I don't have to struggle with it. It's that what is, is. There's that great poem that you have, something about what is, is. It's acceptance is that recognition of what is, is. And we stop pretending otherwise. And with that acceptance, we can hold whatever is there. With an open and compassionate, with a soft, open heart. We hold it within compassion. So suppose you have wanting mind. And you know, there's wanting mind. And you have recognition, and then when you try to move to acceptance, you realize you actually have a flood of judgment. You know, you sort of say, I can't believe I'm so spiritually unevolved, this wanting mind, you know. Thought I gave that wanting thing up a long time ago. I'm completely hopeless because of this. Or you go into, how can I fix this or change this or get rid of this wanting mind? Suppose you go there. So what do you do then? Okay, so you've been in recognition, you try to go to acceptance, and you have judging mind. What do you do? What? Well, even before that, you can then move to recognizing judging mind. So you start rain again. Recognizing judging mind. So you can never be off the hook. No matter what comes up, you can start with recognition. And you can go to acceptance. And when acceptance doesn't work, you recognize whatever that is. Mm-hmm. And the more you do that, the more acceptance will actually come. Mm-hmm. So, let's say you recognize, you have that sense, you're accepting it. There it is. Then there's the investigation. And sometimes I think of investigation as the dynamic aspect of mindfulness. It's sometimes we recognize it, but we sort of, you know, it's kind of over there. I'll recognize it way over there, you know. But the investigation means I get close to it. I actually feel it. I get to know it. I investigate what it feels like in my body and in my mind. I investigate what happens. What are the consequences? Investigation is always in the present moment. We're not asking for an analysis of your childhood. Although sometimes insights might come up. You know, you might suddenly have an image of when this happened to you, something similar as a child or whatever, and that's fine. That's good insight, psychological insight. But the investigation itself is is what is it right now? What does it feel like? And as you investigate it and the subtle feelings in the body and the mind, sometimes you see there's other feelings related to it. There's what I might call truer emotions related to it. Perhaps the wanting mind, you investigate it, feel that kind of wanting. And then you realize right next to it is a deep sadness and loneliness. And then you bring recognition, acceptance to that. So that investigation is the really getting to know it, to become friendly towards it, familiar, get to feel what it's like, to not be afraid of it, to actually let it be. And then the last one, the non-identified. Actually, in my psychosynthesis tradition, we would say disidentifying, and that would spell raid. And so and I kind of toyed with those, but I guess rain sounds kind of nice. So, non-identified in a way, the non-identification has been happening all along. Once with the recognition, there's a kind of you're identifying with it less, and so, and as you do this, the non-identification is actually opening up and expanding. So it means actually seeing what's happening for what it is. Seeing what's happening for what it is, which is passing phenomena. It's just something arising and passing away in the great field of awareness. So there's nothing to identify with. We tend to get very personal about our emotions, and it's me, and I'm this, and, you know, I'm a sleepy person, and I'm no good, and I'm an agitated person, and I should be much calmer, and we have a whole stories and identity all wrapped up in it. But as we, when we go to this ability, this phase, when we open up and we're very present, we just see it's passing phenomena. It's an impermanent state. It's a, you know, thought patterns, body patterns, energy patterns, which are just like weather patterns. We're just passing through. Conditions created them, they arise. Sometimes they're beautiful and wonderful, and sometimes they're stormy, and sometimes they're scary, and all of that. But they come and they go. And the more we realize that that's natural and that's part of our experience, then the easier it becomes to be with them. And the more we're able to do this disidentifying, just be there present, recognizing the arising, the changing, the passing away, we start to see that this is happening in the great open space, that there's a great spaciousness, that their awareness itself is boundless and open and can hold anything. And actually also the unobstructed heart is open and boundless and can hold anything. And we move more away from our fixations and our fixation on our particular story and identity and content. And we move more towards the great open experience of awareness, which is closer to who we truly are. So as we proceed on this retreat, you know, we have the instructions of being aware of the breath, of being aware of the body, and I'll say more tomorrow with the instructions in the morning, but there may be times where very strong mind states, emotions, hindrance states come up, and I invite you to allow time for that to be your object of meditation, where you can begin to hold and practice with that at times. And you might practice with this idea of rain, of recognizing, of accepting it, of investigating, of non-identifying, of this open, welcoming, giving it space. When you feel you can, sometimes it may feel too challenging. I'll say a little bit more about that tomorrow as well. Another factor I want to say is very useful with hindrances and often difficult states is a good sense of humor. And what I call, you know, general amusement at our foibles is a good attitude. Kind of lightening up and just the acknowledgement of our imperfection and our humanity and our shared, that we share, all share in this. Sometimes I want to say too that when something comes up, it is way too painful and too tragic for there to be any humor around it. And in that case, that's when you bring this great sense of caring for the suffering. Caring for the suffering. I'm going to tell you a little story about blocks and these kalashas, or these places where we get kind of bound up. A number of years ago, I did a two-month retreat at Spirit Rock. And I was in a pretty good space. I was pretty concentrated. I felt very clear, pretty empty, pretty happy. I was just going through the retreat feeling pretty happy. And I had an interview with Jack Kornfield, and he says, well, that sounds good, you know. What you're experiencing. And he said, there's two ways my teachers would deal with that. One would say, you're doing just fine, and let that take you wherever it takes you. Then another's teachers would say, well, let's drop little bombshells in that and see what happens. So he said, he gave me these instructions. I don't actually remember all of them exactly, but he basically said, try to evoke some disturbing mind state. Mm-hmm. Try to evoke something and see what happens. So I said, okay, that sounds interesting. Mm-hmm. So since I tend to be a fearful person, I thought, okay, I'll think of some place of fear that I don't really feel like I'm finished with. He was also concerned, I want to say that sometimes people can block out a lot of their, through concentration, you can block out some of the hindrances and different things, but as soon as your concentration weakens, they all come back. So he was sort of testing us to see, you know, what was really going on. So make a longer story shorter, I had some interesting insights, but so I was playing with this fear. So I remember he said first, you know, bring up the fear or whatever it was, be mindful of it, and then hold it in compassion. And then there was following steps to ask it, is it true? Some other questions to ask about it. So I would do that. I would, you know, bring it up in mindfulness, and then I would hold it in compassion. And what I found that as soon as I held it in compassion, it fell apart. No matter what it was, it just would fall apart. And I realized I had this experience that the blocks were where compassion had been withdrawn. And as soon as you put the compassion back, they naturally softened and opened up. And it was a very clear and direct experience at that time. And I can't say in daily life I have it that now that clearly and directly, but I do have a really strong faith and sense of that. In the sense of when you bring back the loving kindness and compassion, that will help those blocks naturally resolve themselves and heal. I did want to say a few things. You know, in the beginning I said there's these blocks, we look at what the blocks are, and you look at what's emerging. So I want to say just a few words about that, what I call the tender sprout, the tender shoot of our Buddha nature that we're nurturing here. In some ways, as teachers, I think of us as sort of master gardeners who You know, sometimes you plant. It's as if people had never gardened. So as a gardener, we've all planted these seeds, and maybe the ground looks really barren. But as master gardeners, we know that there's stuff happening. We know these things are going to sprout. So we're saying, keep with it, keep with it, keep watering it, keep watering it. Let sunshine. It will sprout. It will sprout. And to have some faith in that. But for all of you, you may have some sense of what's emerging. And so I also ask you to reflect on that. And it may be emerging as sometimes I call them whiffs. Whiffs or glimpses of joy, of space, of a kind of contentment or peace, even amidst crisis. Sense of ease, a relaxation, sometimes what I call a happiness for no good reason. love without any particular object. It may be, these are all the different ways that I think you might begin experiencing the emergence of your true nature. And it's you can actually bring rain to those as well. Bring rain, the recognition, the acceptance, the investigation, the non-identification. The magic is, my experience is, the magic is that what is difficult and afflictive becomes healed by mindfulness. And what is wholesome and true is stabilized and nourished. So just a last little bit. I want to say that this is not an easy path in many ways. But I also say, well, what else are you going to do, you know? You're going to get more greed, hatred, delusion, suffering, or are you going to do something, you know, work at it? I was recently taken with a line from a Rumi poem, which I had just been exposed to. It's actually in Tara Brach's book, Radical Acceptance, which I have a class on. And I was very... This really touched something in me. And I'm just going to give one line from it. And it starts out the path of gratitude, because we were talking about gratitude, and this was a Rumi poem about gratitude. But I'm going to drop the gratitude because it's really about the path altogether. And the line is, the path is not for children. It is a path of tender heroes. The path is not for children. It is the path of tender heroes. And this image of the tender hero has really stuck with me. And I sort of have this feeling of looking around at all these tender heroes out here practicing together in this way. And I am almost finished for tonight, and I'm looking at my time. I am going to share I'll call this a bedtime story. Mm-hmm. We're not going to bed yet, though. And this is about a tender hero called Milarepa. Milarepa was a great Tibetan yogi, which is appropriate since we're at a Tibetan center. And Milarepa was also a wilderness yogi, so someone very close to my heart. He practiced alone in the wilderness and the mountains. One day, Milarepa was out gathering some wood and nettles for his dinner, and he was feeling happy with his retreat in the cave high on the mountain. This is a retreat story, so you can maybe relate to some of it. It was a very good day, and he was congratulating himself about how well his retreat was going. He was feeling blissful and joyful. He picked up his wood and returned to his cave. However, when Milarepa arrived back, he found 7 little demons with a body the size of thumbs and the eyes the size of cups, Some were making fire, other bringing water, some were grinding grain, and some sat performing magical tricks. As soon as Milarepa saw them, he became frightened. He didn't know how to make them leave. First, Milarepa meditated on his deity, but that didn't work. He offered a mantra, but that didn't work. He performed a gaze. That's some Tibetan thing. He formed a gaze, and that didn't work. He tried just meditating, and that still didn't work. He was unable to pacify the demons. Does this sound familiar? He's trying all his strategies. Suddenly, Milarepa had a thought. These might be the local demons of this place, and I've been here for months and years, and I've never thanked them for sharing this cave with me. So he sang a song of praise to the cave and the mountains. He talked about what a wonderful place it was for a retreat, and how happy he was to be there. He offered this song of praise to the demons and asked them to drink up his friendliness and to be gone. Three of the demons who were performing magic went away with this offering. But Milarepa was still unable to make the other four go away. And realizing that these four demons were magical obstacles, he sang a song of confidence. He talked about how long he'd been practicing, how as a novice meditator he'd studied with his guru, how as a mature meditator he'd roamed the mountains in solitude, and how he simply wasn't intimidated by these maras and these obstacles. Remember that confidence is one of the factors of enlightenment. Remind you of that. Milarepa said to them, "It's wonderful that you demons came today. You must come again tomorrow, and from time to time we shall converse." And with this confidence, three of the demons disappeared. Mm-hmm. But the remaining demon performed an imposing dance. Milarepa knew that this one was very powerful. So he sang a song to the last demon. He talked about the power of compassion and the power of love. He realized that if he was not able to let go of fear, his sense of love, his trust, his compassion had very little meaning. So Milarepa said to the demon, if you are to stay here longer, that would be fine with me. If you have friends, bring them along. We'll talk out our differences. I feel so much compassion for you. And with friendliness and love, Milarepa placed himself into the mouth of the demon. But the demon couldn't eat him, and it vanished like a rainbow. So let's sit quietly for a moment before the walking.